From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
And the midterm election's right around the corner, as you well know. An up-close look.
This election season is on pace to break the record for most expensive midterms ever at nearly $4 billion.
In the wake of the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United ruling, a new report paints a decidedly bleak picture of politics. The court determined that corporations and unions have the right to express their First Amendment rights with politically directed cash. The only limit placed on these groups is that they do not collude with their favored candidates' campaigns. But the Brennan Center for Justice found that even that sole puny caveat has been pervasively and systematically ignored by candidates and big spenders at all levels of elected government. Consider former Utah Attorney General John Swallow, who used secretive outside interest groups to mask generous campaign donations from payday loan companies, which he subsequently favored with very light regulation. Here's Chi-Sun Lee, co-author of the Brennan Center report.
The New York Times coverage called it the nightmare scenario of campaign finance corruption. In Utah, the campaign finance laws are so lax that even with a multi-million dollar investigation, it's not clear that the law was violated. And so there's been some movement in Utah to reform their campaign finance laws.
Now, if those allegations are true, it's something close to a direct form of bribery. But there are subtler ways for a campaign to influence a supposedly independent donor and vice versa. For example, you have the current race in Florida with Florida Governor Rick Scott trying to raise money for an outside group called Let's Get to Work. And lo and behold, Let's Get to Work is also his campaign slogan. Can you imagine the coincidence?
I spend every day worrying about what my grandson will think of me. I am focused on the photo we leave for his generation. That means more jobs and more opportunity. We made a good start, but there's a lot more work to do.
What do you say?
Let's get to work, Grandpa.
That's my line. Let's get to work.
Sponsored by Let's Get to Work.
What's going on in Florida is both candidates, this is Rick Scott and Charlie Crist, are appearing in these outside television ads. They appear to the viewer as campaign advertisements. They're not, but by working with outside groups, the limitations of the contribution caps are avoided. And this is in a state where direct campaign contributions are capped at $3,000. You know, 96% of the television ad spending on this race is coming from outside groups. That is extraordinary.
What is amazing to me is the impunity with which everyone seems to be behaving. It's as if they're not even trying to pretend that there's any separation between campaigns and super PACs or other outside donors. They use the same slogans, sometimes the same actual images, like Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell in his reelection race for the Senate. And this is a clip from The Daily Show having its way with McConnell over a campaign message which looked suspiciously like B-roll there for the harvesting by independent outsiders.
It's got everything. It's got McConnell's running a board meeting. He's walking around. He's talking. He's frisking some of his younger voters. There are no words. Seriously, the entire ad, it's 2.5 minutes. There's no words. It's just Mitch McConnell and that music. I guess what he's doing is he's making that available to super PACs that he cannot legally coordinate with. So I guess then they can take pieces of it and use it in their pro-McConnell ads. Or he just put it out there so we could have fun with it.
As I say, scarcely even attempting to camouflage what they're up to. How can that be?
Well, across the country, there's a wide range of approaches to regulating campaign finance. So you mentioned when we were talking about the Florida governor's race this year that candidates and outside spenders seem to be coordinating with impunity. Well, in Florida, much of what is happening right now is perfectly legal. And then you will have Minnesota, Vermont, California, Connecticut to some extent, that have actually strengthened their rules after witnessing some of what is going on to make it tougher to coordinate. Another reform effort that Philadelphia just approved is that B-roll issue, the republication of campaign materials. Philadelphia just said ads that use that kind of material produced by campaigns are going to be treated as campaign contributions. They're not going to be treated as actually independent ads.
You and your co-authors made an observation in the report that struck me, and that was that it's really not all about federal elections and the Koch brothers, but local and state elections where relatively obscure people are dominating the political conversation. One example is the state of North Carolina. Can you tell me about Art Pope?
Sure. He's the head of a discount stores conglomerate and has given a great deal of money to state elections in the 2000s. And within that time, there was a shift to a one-party dominated state.
And when the party he supported came to power, he had more than their ear. He had office space.
That's right. The governor at the time appointed Art Pope to be his budget director. And many have explained this as, well, Art Pope ran a successful company. He holds a law degree from Duke University. At the same time, others raised questions about the connection between his tremendously generous political giving that transformed the state's political makeup and his step up to an incredibly powerful position where, under his watch, there were certain tax cuts and cuts to social services that became controversial enough that even some of the conservative elected officials he had supported expressed some concern.
We had Heather Gerken from Yale on last week, and she made an interesting observation that the hydraulics of campaign finance are such that whatever rules you make, the money will find a place to penetrate whatever barriers law and regulation tries to erect.
Of course, huge spending has long been the way of American politics. But when we looked at how different states are enforcing very different kinds of laws, and you look at jurisdictions like California, for instance, that has been very active in its enforcement and also in its advising of candidates and outside groups. Connecticut is another state that's been very active in speaking to the public about the rules and in enforcing against infractions. This sends a message, I think, to a meaningful extent, setting the culture of what is acceptable and the norm in political spending does matter. For instance, you saw after Citizens United, outside spending shot up where they had restrictions similar to the federal restrictions that were struck down. But you also saw spending shoot up in states that already permitted independent spending to be unlimited by corporations and unions. And some experts have said that has to do with the culture that having an outside group engage in huge amounts of spending sort of didn't seem as unseemly because everybody else was doing it.
Chi-Sun, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Chi-Sun Lee is a professor of law at the New York University School of Law and co-author of the Brennan Center Report. On the subject of Citizens United and dark money, I'm delighted to report that a new TV film has been released, timed for the midterms, that savages unregulated spending by billionaires, political attack ads, gerrymandering, partisan groups posing as public interest organizations, and the imposition on unwilling voters of an extremist social agenda.
This is how a tiny club of secretive elites assumed control over a state of 5 million people.
That's Michelle Malkin in the documentary titled Rocky Mountain Heist, about a shadowy cabal that subverted democracy in Colorado. The producer, a little outfit called Citizens United.
You might not recognize Colorado today. To understand the Rocky Mountain heist, you have to begin with the Colorado model, an underground network of extremist liberal groups so secretive that veteran conservative lawmakers like Ted Harvey didn't see it coming.
There was no way we could respond. We didn't have the resources to be able to respond, and the media was totally off guard.
What follows is a thoroughgoing, sober analysis of what ails our democracy.
Tiny club of secretive elites, their radical far-left agenda.
An underground network of extremist liberal groups.
The radical environmentalists.
Open season on economic liberty and personal liberty.
The most partisan, most brutal, most activist, and most elitist I have ever seen.
It's definitely an attack on liberty.
Liberal elites, the radical agenda, widespread fraud, liberal East Coast values on freedom-loving Rocky Mountain citizens. Ultra-liberal agenda.
You lose your individual liberty.
Through secrecy, deception, and coordination.
Can we discuss irony? It was a legal challenge against Citizen United's previous docu-horror flick, Hillary the Movie, that in 2010 led to the Supreme Court decision we just discussed. And earlier this month, a federal court affirmed Citizens United's right to broadcast the Rocky Mountain heist as a documentary, as opposed to a 45-minute campaign ad. And what evil does the documentary warn us of? The unholy alliance of money and ideology that threatens to deprive us of our liberty, paid for by the following donors. Oh, wait. We have no way of knowing. Rocky Mountain Heist has a wonderful and diverse cast consisting entirely of Republican politicians, operatives, and pundits, plus one gaggle of utterly fried stoners.
And I love myself, and I love everybody, and I want the best for everybody and myself in Colorado.
Plus Seth Maskett. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Denver, who you could categorize as none of the above. Maskett wrote about his role in the film for a Washington Post op-ed titled, How I Ended Up Starring in a Citizens United Film. He says his star turn began with a call last summer from the film's director and co-writer, Jason Meath.
He contacted me, identified himself as an independent filmmaker, said he was working on a documentary on Colorado politics, and had some questions for me on things like campaign finance and the changing political nature of the state. And these are all things I've written on before. I teach in my classes and have given a number of interviews before, so I was happy to grant this interview. I didn't know this person, but checked out his website, looked at some clips from previous films he'd made, and everything really seemed on the up and up. I was not told at the time the title of the film or who was backing it and who was going to be putting it out. I did sign a release form, but the name Citizen United didn't appear in that at all. I actually didn't have much sense of where the interview was going to end up, only just assuming it was going to end up in some sort of documentary.
After that was over with, did you have any sense of what was to come?
Well, not really. The interview, I thought, went very well. Then really didn't hear back from the guy for several months. It wasn't until I was doing expert testimony in a federal court case. Citizens United was seeking to release a new film, Rocky Mountain Heist, in Colorado, and they didn't want to disclose who had donated money to produce the film. The Colorado Secretary of State informed them that because this was a campaign activity, they had to disclose their donors, and so they were suing the Secretary of State for the right to air this without donors. The Secretary of State's office retained me as a witness to basically talk about the value of campaign finance disclosure, and it was during my cross-examination that their lead counsel asked me, first he asked me if I'd seen the film. I said no, and then he asked me if I knew I was in it.
I just want to make sure this is clear. You were testifying as an expert witness in favor of disclosure of so-called dark money in political campaigns.
Correct.
And the subject at hand was this film, Rocky Mountain Heist, which was kind of Exhibit A. And you're in the film you're testifying against.
Yeah.
That must have been a little on the surreal side.
This was the first I knew about it, so I was rather stunned. The attorneys who had brought me there also were a bit stunned by it. And spent the next few hours trying to figure out just where they would have gotten an interview with me. and traced back to what I had assumed was this previous interview I did earlier in the summer.
As I counted it, you were in the film three times. The first two were very small tape cuts that seemed to have been gathered and presented pretty straightforwardly.
The State House switched from Republican to Democratic for the first time in about 40 years. There was an analysis done by the Denver Post looking at the 2010 race, and it was hopelessly complex.
Okay, so except for maybe the haunting music, it's pretty neutral, right?
Right, yeah. I don't remember the menacing music while I was speaking, but otherwise, yeah.
And then clip three, which, as I understand from your piece in the Washington Post, you regard as a textbook case of how to twist something by abusing the context. Here's what it sounds like.
Latinos have not only been increasing in their potential to vote, but they have been voting increasingly Democratic over the last 10 years in Colorado.
If those folks coming across that border all ended up voting conservative Republican, there'd be a 50-foot-high wall with broken glass on the top.
I simply reported on a demographic and political shift, that the number of Latino residents in Colorado has been increasing, their tendency to vote Democratic has been increasing, and that's easily verifiable. It's a pretty uncontroversial statement. It was just sort of the context that was put it in that makes it sound much more emotionally charged.
Did you try to get in touch with the director of this film?
I was bothered there that, I guess you could view it either as two ways. One, that I was endorsing this rather sinister-sounding narrative, or on the other side, that my very neutral approach was helping to support this narrative that others were portraying. Either way, I didn't really like the way I was being used in there. The filmmaker got in touch with me just a few days before the release of the film to thank me for my appearance in it, and he offered me a link so I could view it, and I asked him to remove me from it. You know, this was, again, just a few days before, and that was really the first time I'd been able to confirm that I was indeed in this film and that my appearance stemmed from my interview with him. And he said, no, it's too late at this point. You signed a release. I'm not going to remove you from this film. And at that point, my understanding was I really had very little recourse. It was just going to happen.
Is there any larger lesson that you see that you think you'd like to be your closing thought on this subject?
Two quick thoughts. If you're ever asked to do an interview, you know, do some research. Be very clear about who you're interviewing with. The other is just a point about the importance of political disclosure. There's certainly no shortage of money and advertising and filming going on in politics today, and I don't necessarily have a problem with that. I think generally the more information that's out there, usually the better. But, you know, people should really know where it's coming from. That's just one of the basic things that voters need in order to make reasonable decisions.
Seth, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Seth Maskett is an associate professor of political science at the University of Denver. We reached out to the president of Citizens United, David Bossie, and to the director of Rocky Mountain Heist, Jason Meath. They both declined to be interviewed.
Coming up, a cautionary tale of what happens when one company owns both the means of producing content and the sole way of distributing it. It's a huge company, and you've never heard of it.
That's what she said. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In an average minute, 100 hours of video are uploaded to YouTube. 2,460,000 new Facebook posts appear. And 433,000 new tweets are tweeted. All of these services and others like them rely on a massive workforce of content moderators to flag the illegal or profoundly offensive. They are the line that stands between users and videos of beheadings, child pornography, animal torture, illegal solicitation, and all manner of the unimaginable and unspeakable. Wired contributor Adrian Chen headed to the Philippines, where, it seems, much of the content moderation happens.
Part of it is just because it's really cheap to hire these people there, and there's already this call center infrastructure. And if you talk to a lot of content moderation companies, they'll tell you that the Philippines, because they were a former U.S. colony, have a better sense of what Americans find objectionable or not.
You mean they have a more direct line into the U.S. psyche?
Yeah, that's what they claim. And I have talked to some people who mentioned that a company had tried to outsource to India and it just didn't work because they weren't able to parse what is just a risque photo and what is not allowed by these companies.
Do you have an example of that that can be used on the radio?
A story that somebody told me was we would get videos and photos of people in bikinis, and if a bikini is a certain length, then it's not allowed. If it's another length, it is. And I guess the people in India were just nuking all bikini photos.
You said that it's a lot cheaper to hire people abroad, which seems obvious, but exactly how cheap is it?
I talked to one guy who the least he was offered was $300 a month. And after working at another place for many months, he ended up making around $500 a month.
Not a living wage here.
No, definitely not. Although it's actually a pretty good wage in the Philippines.
So you actually went to Manila. You mentioned a company called Whisper. Describe what Whisper does and then talk about the day-to-day work of a content moderator.
Well, Whisper is an app that allows you to share secrets anonymously. One of the challenges with that is that if you don't moderate it very heavily, it's just going to devolve into all sorts of abuse and illegal things. And so they moderate every single thing that's posted on their service. Most services will just do things that are flagged by moderators, but every single photo or post that's on Whisper will be seen by somebody in the Philippines. There's this big whiteboard where they have written down the different categories of things they're looking for, you know, porn, underage photos, violence, hate speech. They actually also get a regular report from their headquarters of what's kind of going on in the U.S. in pop culture, things they should be on the lookout for. So if Justin Bieber does something, then, you know, they'll know that it's not just people bullying somebody named Justin or something.
You talk to a number of people who have done this, and it starts out seeming like a pretty good job, right? Somebody got to watch Battlestar Galactica on one screen while just casually casting his eye on the photos streaming on the other screen. Describe what some of those experiences were like and how they might have changed.
It's important to note that some of this is being done in the U.S. by kind of recent college graduates who don't really have any other option for employment in the tech industry. It seems like an easy way to make a pretty good wage. It's, you know, not super labor intensive. It's not working in food service. But one guy that I talked to who did this, when he started out, he was able to just kind of absorb all of these images. But after a while, it ended up psychologically wearing him down. And this was compounded by the fact that he realized that he wasn't going to get a job at Google through this. And so it was kind of the combination of, oh, I'm just this disposable thing that's supposed to be soaking up all this horrible stuff, and also the actual content that he's having to see.
What you're soaking up is the darkest side of the human id.
I mean, it's basically the worst images you can imagine, you know, child abuse, really extreme violence.
Committed on helpless people or helpless animals, people who seem to be doing it for the sheer pleasure that they derive from it.
Yeah, the guy who moderated for YouTube, he said that for some reason the animal abuse was always the hardest for him. He saw a video of somebody setting a dog on fire to discipline it, and that's something that's really stuck with him.
One psychologist you spoke to in Manila, she likened the after effects of too much of this work to PTSD.
There are just such vivid and horrific images that you can't really help but dwell on it. I also met a quality assurance representative named Maria, and she worked for a firm that does content moderation for a cloud storage service based in the U.S. And her job was to basically double check the actual agents who were doing the screening to make sure they didn't miss anything and they were filling out the forms right. But she was more concerned about the people she was supervising, because she's seen that some of them have become very paranoid, especially with regards to their children. They don't want to leave their kids with babysitters because they've seen such horrible things in their job.
I think one of the things that struck me is that this work demands human beings, clued into American mores and laws.
this has to be done by brute force of eyes and clicking fingers. Is there no alternative to human moderation?
Well, everyone I talked to said there was no way a robot could do all of this. They can come up with programs and algorithms that will make it more effective and more streamlined, but there's always going to be somebody who has to look at it. And also, the kinds of moderation that's going on is getting more and more nuanced and complicated. And so I think you're always going to need people, and probably more and more people as time goes on.
So more than the estimated 100,000 people to immerse themselves in human depravity to protect us from it. You don't see any way around it?
I talked to a professor named Sarah Roberts, who's the only person that I know of doing serious research on this. And she said it's kind of a question of human nature. And until we solve that problem, this problem's never going to go away.
Adrian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Adrian Chen is a contributor to Wired Magazine. Video services consume most of the bandwidth on the web. Some you've probably heard of, YouTube, Netflix, Twitch. But there's one bandwidth behemoth you may not know, at least by name, MindGeek. Despite its low profile, MindGeek has over 100 million daily visitors. It operates nearly 100 websites and consumes more bandwidth than Facebook, Twitter, and Amazon. How has MindGeek achieved such success so anonymously? The answer has to do with MindGeek's line of business, pornography, and its path to success offers a cautionary tale even to those disinclined to its content. In a piece titled Vampire Porn, Slate writer David Auerbach explains how MindGeek gained a virtual stranglehold on porn by snapping up something called tube sites.
That's sort of the term of art, as they might say, for a YouTube-like service that is dedicated to pornography.
And supported by ads.
Yeah, they don't make money through subscriptions or logons. They're purely supported through ad revenue.
And MindGeek controls 8 out of the top 10 of these tube sites?
Yes, they started off with one, and sort of from the revenue from that, they were able to acquire others. And apparently they're in talks to acquire possibly one of the remaining 2 of the top 10.
Wow. And a lot of this stuff is pirated.
Yes, that's the really fascinating sort of Ouroboros-like aspect of this story. Once MindGeek obtained a fair amount of revenue, mostly off of this pirated content from their tube sites, they then began purchasing pornography content producers, including companies like Brazzers and Vivid. And these were sort of upscale mainstream pornography production companies. And their content had already been being pirated on tube sites for years. After the purchase of these companies, rather than cracking down on piracy, it's being used as a way to sort of divert funds and wages away from the content producers and just have the revenues come in through ads and go directly to the MindGeek, so that wages and revenues for the content producers remain low, even though the same parent company is profiting off of it.
And as we've seen in a lot of creative areas, the people who are suffering are the people who create the material. And I know a lot of people, including government regulators, don't have a lot of sympathy for people in the porn industry. But as you note in your piece, in the last decade or so, almost every porn star has to freelance as an escort, and that didn't used to be the case.
Yes. Several people remarked that maybe 15 years ago, it was uncommon for porn stars to moonlight or support themselves through prostitution escort work. And now it is very, very common, simply because wages have fallen and production has fallen by something on the order of 75%. And while you still have other producers like Hustler that are still around, because so many of these sites, even if they're not owned, they still depend on advertising purchased by MindGeek companies. So basically, they have the power to sort of blacklist or shut out people to the extent that it can really threaten people's profits and livelihoods if they decide they don't like you.
So creativity in the industry is being squashed, I think it's fair to say.
Yes.
And at the same time,
MindGeek has over 100 million daily visitors and is certainly in the top 10 of bandwidth users and possibly in the top 3 alongside YouTube and Netflix. That's huge. It's hiding in plain sight.
I suppose, much like pornography in general, it is hiding in plain sight. You know, MindGeek, the brand itself, is unknown to most people. This manifests also itself in terms of their business dealings, which is that in 2011, MindGeek, which was then known as Manwin, was able to get a $350 million loan from Wall Street. And the way that loan was secured to avoid the appearance of Wall Street investing in pornography was that it was tranched on Wall Street in something like half a dozen or even a dozen individual loans that were then moved through a very small capital firm so that it was not at all obvious that anyone who invested in these loans was investing in a pornography company.
But, you know, all that said, that this is a huge rampaging monopoly that's consuming astonishing amounts of bandwidth and is funded by money hidden in a lot of little tranches and which is hiding in plain sight. Why should we care? And I think you begin to provide the answer in your piece when you write, MindGeek's dominance should serve as a cautionary tale of the dangers of consolidating production and distribution in a single monopolistic owner.
Yes. Well, look at it this way. Right now, there's a lot of television movies that Netflix doesn't make available streaming because the people who own that content, even if they additionally own cable companies or channels or even internet service providers, want to make the most money off of that content before they allow it to be streamed. And so they're negotiating. Now, imagine if Netflix then just owns the content providers. That negotiation doesn't happen. And so there's less money that then flows to the content provider owner and then back to the content producer. There's more incentives to collect perhaps less revenue if it results in more revenue that's going directly to the company itself rather than revenue negotiated through contracts between the content producers and the people working for the content producers like actors and writers and directors.
Maybe one day MindGeek will buy YouTube.
As I understand it, MindGeek is not the most well-run company. They've had some corruption issues. The Secret Service seized their bank accounts in 2009. The ex-CEO was arrested for tax evasion in 2012. So it may be sort of a dying vampire that sort of takes a lot of other companies with it and then dies out having sort of sucked the industry dry.
The porn industry dry?
I didn't say that.
David Auerbach is a writer and software engineer based in New York. He wrote the article Vampire Porn for Slate.
Coming up, it's reassuring to hear that despite all the coverage, the incidence of mass shootings is not rising. It's also wrong.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone, about to bust a popular media myth. You won't like it. In the last month, at least two shootings have made national news.
A scary situation underway right now in Ottawa. The shootings outside the Canadian Parliament. Also reports of gunfire inside the halls of Parliament.
There has been another school shooting in this country, this time at a high school north of Seattle in Marysville, Washington, where a student started shooting in the school cafeteria.
The D.C. Navy Yard, Santa Barbara, Aurora, Newtown, shootings resound on the airwaves, occurring with what feels like greater frequency. But that feeling, experts tell us, is wrong.
There has been no increase. So it's not an epidemic. It's not on the rise.
There are so many mass shootings that are happening, not more frequently, but they're getting more attention than ever before.
We should focus on trend lines, not headlines. And the trend line here is flat.
Would that that were true. But it all depends on how you define a mass shooting. Northeastern University criminologist James Allen Fox, who we just heard, defines a mass shooting as any homicide, including domestic shootings and gang violence, in which four or more are killed with a gun. Defined that way, then yes, the trend line is flat. But those headline-grabbing incidents, a guy with a gun shooting in a place like a school or a theater or a shopping mall, those incidents are increasing. You were right all along. That's according to new research from the Harvard School of Public Health and Northeastern University in association with Mother Jones. To find the relevant data, says Harvard Research Associate Deborah Azriel, you only have to disaggregate the mayhem. To illustrate, she uses a medical analogy.
If you look at cancer rates in the United States, they've largely been going down and pretty steadily over the past 30 years, say. There's one really notable exception, which is lung cancer rates among women, which have gone up over that period. If we look at cancer rates overall, we will not see this important subgroup of cancers that's increasing and try to address those. Similarly, we have the capacity to make sensible subgroups out of that category of four or more people killed with a gun. And to lump them all together, we do it at our peril.
So people wielding a gun in public places, not domestic, not gang-related, those incidents are on the rise?
Starting in 1982, prior to about 2011, mass public shootings of the sort we've been talking about came on average about every 172 days. Since sometime in 2011, what we see is that they've now been coming on average about every 64 days.
Why 2011? Any guesses?
We need to figure that out. We know, for example, that the prevalence of mental health issues didn't change in 2011. We didn't have big changes in firearm-related laws in 2011. We didn't have big changes in any number of things that might explain it. So we have to look more closely. What you really have to understand is that far less than 1% of all homicides are public mass shootings. One of the reasons why you want to sort of parse this out is we're looking at a really rare event that's nonetheless distinct. We want to be able to respond to it.
So do you have a breakdown of the different kinds of shootings, which have gone up, which have gone down?
There isn't a good data set. So it's done crudely with circumstance information that's provided by the FBI or looking at news reports and the like. The good news is that in the wake of Newtown, one of President Obama's executive orders was to expand the National Violent Death Reporting System, which is run by the CDC and collects data on all homicides, suicides, and accidental firearm deaths in the United States. And that data set, which was in 18 states and is now in 38 states, collects the kind of detailed information on these incidents that you really would want to know. How many people were killed? How many people were shot but not killed? Did the shooter kill him or herself? And it provides a narrative as to what happened.
How do you suggest we use that information?
One approach is to really ask ourselves, can we identify something that happened, you know, around 2010, 2011, that might plausibly have changed the frequency of these events? Maybe media reporting makes a difference, that there's a sort of contagion. We also know that there are changes happening now in response to these shootings. Police have changed the way they intervene. You know, they go in and try to interrupt an event before more people die. Those sorts of things might, in fact, lead to a shift that would result in them coming less frequently. That's the kind of question we need to be in the position to ask and then to answer as we try to do things now. The other thing we can do is look at domestic homicides. My guess is that those haven't changed very much, that that's what's driving the claim that there hasn't been a change in mass homicides. So why have we not been able to make an impact on those kinds of domestic homicides? If you want to understand any phenomenon, you need to count it carefully, disaggregate big groups of deaths into sensible subsets. You don't want to mix apples and oranges.
Deborah, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Harvard Research Associate Deborah Azriel, exploding a media myth we really would have preferred to believe.
The recently released documentary Citizen 4 from filmmaker Laura Poitras is a portrait of NSA leaker Edward Snowden. Here he is in the film, sequestered in his hotel room in Hong Kong, days before the world hears his name for the first time.
I think pretty much as soon as they start trying to make this about me, which should be any day now, I'll come out just to go, hey, you know, this is not a question of somebody skulking around in the shadows, and I'm not afraid of you.
Snowden says he's not afraid, but he knows what he's up against. A telling moment in the movie comes when Poitras films him covering his whole body with a red cloak before typing in a password to his laptop. And ultimately, he went on the lam. But there are others who have defied the government's secrecy programs who also appear in the Snowden film, who chose another route. Manoush Zomorodi spoke to them in the latest episode of her podcast, New Tech City.
There are two other people who appear in Citizen 4. Two guys who are defying the government in the name of your privacy, even if you and I don't care as much as maybe we should. William Binney, the former NSA cryptographic genius, who actually designed much of the government's data snooping architecture.
So whatever resource they need, they get, and it ultimately comes from the people, and it's being used against the people.
Our very own tax dollars are being used against us.
And Ladar Levison, the man behind the secure email service called LavaBit that was used by Edward Snowden to send those emails to Laura Poitras. We got them together to find out what makes a privacy crusader tick. And in talking to them, we discovered that there are three key reasons that they've turned over their lives to the privacy cause. The first reason, moral dilemma. The government asked both of these men to betray one of their core values. Now, if you don't know Ladar Levison, last year he talked about when the FBI knocked on his door. They wanted to be able to snoop on the people using his encrypted mail service, LavaBit.
It put me in an ethically compromising position, yeah. I was being trusted to run a secure and private service. That's what I advertised. And if I felt that if I was no longer a secure and private service because I was sharing information with the federal government in an uncontrolled and unaudited manner, I would be breaking that promise that I was making through my website.
So Levison refuses to turn over the digital keys to his email service, LavaBit. The courts insist. So Ladar hands them over, but he also shuts down the company, so the keys are useless. He basically burns his business to the ground to protect his users' privacy. Ladar was asked to choose between the government and his customers. And because he chose his customers, Ladar assumes that he is constantly being tracked by the government. So he really is the perfect person to ask, among other things, what about that crazy red cape that Snowden puts over his head in the movie Citizen 4? What's he worried about, that there's like cameras somewhere that the NSA can read his password?
Or even just a microphone that records the number of key presses. You know, if they knew that the password was 11 characters as opposed to 13 or 10, then they know that they only need to try 11 character combinations. It, of course, becomes more real in terms of a threat when you're talking about a room that might have a camera, maybe even a hidden camera, like in your smoke detector looking straight down at your keyboard. And it only takes one very small mistake to compromise your security. I was recently studying World War II. The reason we were able to break the German encryption scheme, the Tunny system, was because a German communications officer sent the same 4,000-character communication twice without rotating the encryption key. That one very so tiny mistake was what allowed researchers at Bletchley Park in the United Kingdom to break the Tunny encryption system.
So it takes only one screw-up if someone is actively trying to get your data. So basically, Ladar says, if you're going to be paranoid, just make sure you're paranoid all the way. That's where he stands after the FBI put him in his moral dilemma. But you might be surprised how William Binney responds.
I don't buy into that. That's why I'm doing everything in public.
William Binney, or Bill as he's known, is one of the very best code breakers ever at the NSA. He was there for over three decades, cracking encryption from the Soviet Union on up through 9/11. And here's the thing about Bill. He is the one who created some of the amazing NSA programs. He explained one of them to Laura Poitras in a video for the New York Times back in 2012, before the Snowden leaks.
After 9/11, they took one of the programs I had done, or the back end part of it, and started to use it to spy on everybody in this country. So, and that was a program they created called Stellar Wind.
Binney never thought that Stellar Wind would be used on U.S. citizens, and he was outraged. He quit the NSA, went public about it. Call him the pre-Edward Snowden NSA whistleblower. So naturally, this ends his career with the government. And it also gets his house raided in 2007 by FBI agents who are looking for evidence.
So, but they did that, and they came in and pointed the gun at me when I was getting out of the shower at the time. So they pointed a gun right at my old head, you know, and said, hey. So I wasn't too upset. I just said, yeah, I suppose I could get dressed here. they weren't intimidating me anyway, so.
That was the fallout of Bill Binney's moral choice. Since then, he's been something of a gadfly to the intelligence community, an extremely smart gadfly who knows exactly what the threat of spying truly entails. Now, here's the second reason he and Ladar keep going. They have faith in us, the uneducated public, and they are willing to tutor us patiently.
You say in the movie, Bill, you say that the best way to do things now, the best way to fight against the government is actually what Deep Throat was doing, that that's the only way you could really be sure of your privacy is to meet your source in a parking garage and whisper to them.
That's correct. The old-fashioned way, analog.
And the fact is, even if you're an expert like myself, I can't audit every device, every application that I use to ensure that it's not opening me up to attack. We heard in the early days of the Snowden leaks that Angry Birds was actually transmitting private information about people's who they were communicating with and how often to the Angry Birds servers in the clear so that anybody who controlled the network in between could harvest that information and throw it into a database. I mean, so just installing that one free game would open people up to surveillance.
Yep, even Angry Birds. Okay, so far they've had a moral dilemma. They've shown how much faith they have in us, the mostly uneducated public, and now the third reason. They see the future, and they know what their role is in shaping how we live with technology going forward.
You know, everything that happened to me gave me a soapbox to stand upon, and if I'm doing anything, it's trying to use that soapbox to make a positive difference.
Levison is working to improve the code behind his old email service, Lavabit, and he's going to release it as a new service called Darkmail. But for Bill Binney, he wants to be your proxy in a U.S. court eventually. He's hoping that the U.S. government sues him for speaking out about his old work at the NSA.
They're in direct violation of the Constitution, and I want to make that absolutely clear to everybody and do it in open court where they can't hide. I would not buy into a silenced approach. If I couldn't explain it in court, I'd do it on the steps of the court so that everybody would know.
Just touching upon what Bill was talking about, I know for 36 years you worked for the agency out of a patriotic sense that you were protecting this country. And I'm just wondering if you feel like everything that you've done in the last 10 years stems from that same sense of patriotic duty.
Absolutely. I took an oath to defend the Constitution of the United States, not the president or the NSA or any other agency in the government. I took an oath to defend those principles.
Two men and their three reasons for turning their lives over to the privacy cause. What do you think, Ladar? Meet Bill on the steps of the Supreme Court?
I would be there.
Manoush Zomorodi is the host of WNYC's New Tech City, a podcast devoted to exploring how technology is changing our lives. You can listen at WNYC.org or subscribe through iTunes. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Kimmy Regular, Mira Sharma, and Andrew Chug. We had more help from Kasia Mihailovich, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone. advising you to check out New Tech City.
And I'm Bob Garfield, and I agree.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.